This podcast is brought to you by BMJ Best Practice. BMJ Best Practice offers evidence-based, continually updated, and practical knowledge that will help you make better clinical decisions.
Hello and welcome to this BMJ Best Practice podcast on acute cervical spine trauma. Kieran Walsh is my name. I'm Clinical Director at BMJ. In young people, cervical spine injuries result primarily from motor vehicle accidents, sports activities, and diving into shallow water. In older people, falls are a common cause. But whatever age, these injuries are common and important. They can cause a range of complications, from pain to radiculopathy to further neurological disability. So it's important that we get the diagnosis and management of cervical spine trauma right. To give us more details about the problem and what we can do about it, we have on the line Michael Failings, Professor of Neurosurgery at the University of Toronto, and importantly, author of our BMJ Best Practice topic on this condition. So Michael, you're welcome. Let's start off by asking, what exactly is acute cervical spine trauma?
Yes, thank you. So in a nutshell, cervical spine trauma reflects a traumatic injury that occurs to the neck and to the cervical spine. This can be blunt in nature from, for example, a sports injury, motor vehicle, a collision, a fall, or it could be penetrating in the form of violence, such as from a gunshot wound or, for example, a stabbing injury.
Okay, thank you. And how do you assess the patient and make the diagnosis?
So it's critical to have a knowledge of the mechanism of injury. So what exactly occurred? What were the circumstances? So was this a low velocity type of an injury or a high velocity injury? And then looking at the age and the demographics of the patient are going to be important. And does the individual have neck pain? Do they have neurologic complaints? Are they complaining of radicular arm pain? Are they complaining of hand or arm weakness? Can they walk or not? Is there impairment of bowel or bladder function? And so what's critical here is the history and then the physical examination will focus on the overall assessment of the patient. Is this an isolated injury or is this in the context of polytrauma? And about 10% of patients with a traumatic brain injury will have involvement of the cervical spine and vice versa, so that it's important to understand, has there been a head injury or not? The neurological examination is critical and one needs to undertake a detailed examination of the upper and lower extremities, examining the key motor groups in the ASR or INSCI scale is quite helpful here. Sensory examination, and then an examination of the neck. Is it tender? Has there been penetrating or signs of non-penetrating injuries such as bruising? Most patients who have a suspected neck injury will arrive in a cervical collar. And so the removal of the cervical collar needs to be done carefully with a careful inspection of the neck. If the patient is neurologically intact and does not complain of neck pain, and if the type of injury has been a low velocity trauma, you can carefully examine the range of motion of the neck to make sure that this is not associated with pain. On the other hand, if there's a neurological injury or if there's a high type of velocity injury, the neck collar should not really be removed until imaging has been obtained.
Okay, thank you. A fantastic amount in all of that. Just one thing that I missed. You mentioned a scale, I think, used in assessment. Can you tell me what that is again?
Yes. So this is a scale of neurological assessment for spinal cord injury. This was developed by the American Spinal Injury Association. It's been referred to as the ASIA scale and was subsequently adopted internationally. And this refers to the international standards in the neurological classification of spinal cord injury, or INSCI. And so this is referenced in our BMJ documents on the assessment and management of spine trauma. And in a nutshell, there are five key myotomes in the upper extremity and the lower extremities that are then graded using the classical MRC grading scale from 0 to 5. And you can actually print out a diagram, and you can just tick the boxes. And it's actually quite handy to do that as part of the patient record. And then another element of the assessment of this is to examine the dermatomes. So these are the classic dermatomes that we're taught to assess. And in particular, say someone's had a spinal cord injury, is there a sensory level that you will then document? And then from this as well, if there's a spinal cord injury or not, you can grade the individual A, B, C, D, or E. E is neurologically intact. A is someone who has a complete loss of motor and sensory function below the level. A B injury has some sensory sparing, particularly around the perianal and rectal area, but no motor function. And grade C and D are neurologic assessments where there is partial presence of motor function. Grade C is less than grade 3 out of 5 in key myotomes on the MRC scale. And a D is where there's minimal weakness with motor function of at least grade 3 or more in the key myotomes.
Okay, thank you. That's very helpful, very clear. Let's move on to tests needed to make the diagnosis or to assess the patient. What tests do you typically need to do?
So imaging is critical, and there still is a role for plain films, although they have been supplanted in many institutions by the use of thin section CT scans with reconstructions. And this partly depends on your own institutional protocols. But a set of cervical spine x-rays are quite helpful as an initial screening point. But if there's a significant concern related to, say, a high velocity type of a trauma, if the patient has neurological complaints, there should be a low threshold to obtain a CT scan. And these are typically at least 3 millimeter cuts, preferably thinner, but at least 3 millimeter cuts. And they should extend from the skull base, so to include the cranial cervical junction, and they should go down to the upper thoracic spine, because the cervical thoracic junction is difficult to see on plain films, and the CT scan should go down to the C2 level. And so the CT scan is a critical imaging point. And then the role of an MRI. If the patient has neurologic complaints, radiculopathy, or signs of spinal cord impairment, an MRI should be obtained. And then when else should an MRI be obtained? In children and young people, there's a phenomenon called SCI-WARA, which is spinal cord injury without radiographic abnormality. And one needs to be careful here because the x-rays and the CT scan won't show signs of a fracture, but there's an injury to the ligamentous structures that can then result in an injury to the cord or the neural elements. And this is really only diagnosed by MRI. And then another group of patients where there's also a pitfall in diagnosis are older individuals who have a fall. And in these people, they can have an injury to the cervical spinal cord called the central cord syndrome. And there may not be a fracture that you see at all. And you need to be careful not to miss this. And so an MRI should be obtained if you, say, have an older individual, they have a fall, they're having burning in their hands, and you know they've got neurologic complaints, and yet there's no evidence of a fracture. Get an MRI in these individuals to assess the cervical cord.
Fantastic. I was going to ask you about MRI, but you beat me to it. I was also going to ask you about pitfalls in diagnosis, which you started off as well. Any other pitfalls besides the ones that you mentioned?
Yes. So One needs to be careful in the assessment of patients who are intoxicated, who've had a mild traumatic brain injury, maybe concussed, or if there's a significant other trauma, say in a polytrauma patient, It's called a distracting injury. So for example, say if someone comes in with a road traffic accident, they've got a femur fracture, they're going to be in a lot of pain related to this. So be careful not to quote unquote clinically clear the cervical spine because the patient tells you they don't have neck pain. You want to, in those patients, get a CT scan of the cervical spine anyway because of the presence of a distracting injury and a high velocity trauma. So those are kind of a couple of pitfalls. And then a few others. If you look at where are fractures or areas of instability missed, they fall into patterns. So the craniocervical junction, pay careful attention with your eyes to look at that, and the cervicothoracic junction. The craniocervical junction is hard to assess on plain films, as is the cervicothoracic junction. So look at the CT scan. This is, I think, where the CT scan can be quite helpful to make sure that you have not missed subtle signs of an atlanto-occipital dislocation or perhaps an odontoid fracture or an injury at the C7-T1 level. And then I briefly referenced Sciwara and central cord syndrome, but it merits kind of a repeat. So again, Sciwara, spinal cord injury without radiographic abnormality in children. So for example, say you have a child coming in, maybe they've had a gymnastics injury and they're complaining of some kind of funny neurologic complaints, or maybe they had some funny neurologic complaints that come in, they're now neurologically normal. Be aware that they could have a ligamentous injury with instability that you might miss even on a CT scan. So get an MRI on those patients. And then the other individuals are the older individuals who have spondylosis in the cervical spine. They often will complain of weakness in the hands. They may be moving all four extremities, but they have weakness in the hands and burning in the hands. And there may not be a fracture on the CT scan. Get an MRI to assess for cord compression. And I see that those are by far the most common pitfalls that I see as a clinician.
Fantastic. Thank you. Let's move on to management. Tell us what the mainstay of management is.
So one needs to first define, has there been an injury to the cervical spine? And what is the nature of that injury? Is there a fracture? Is there a dislocation? Is there a ligamentous injury? And we would endorse the cervical spine injury classification from the AO spine working group. And we make reference to this in our BMJ document. And in a nutshell, one classifies injuries as A, B, or C. A are involving the anterior column. So these might be just a little compression fracture, or they might actually be a burst fracture of the vertebra. A B injury involves the bending elements posteriorly of the cervical spine, so ligamentous or if there's facet injuries. And a C injury is if there's any evidence of a dislocation, any degree of subluxation or deformity. And then does the patient have evidence of a neurologic injury? Is it a nerve root injury? They have radiculopathy of an individual nerve root, or is there evidence of a cervical spine injury? So I think one of the critical aspects of the management is the diagnosis. So management to me is an algorithm where it's diagnosis and then treatment, and then the treatment flows from the diagnosis. And so if this is a very minor injury that's occurred, and the patient really doesn't have much in the way of neck pain, and may have a good range of motion on the cervical spine, you can clear that patient and they're safe to leave. On the other hand, if you have someone where there's been an injury that is high velocity, you need to have a much higher index of suspicion before you clear the spine. And at least a CT scan and perhaps more advanced imaging, such as an MRI scan, should be used. And then if there's evidence of a spinal cord injury, then that brings in a whole set of additional protocols that are made reference to management of a spinal cord injury. But if that diagnosis is made, you need to involve specialists, either a neurosurgeon or an orthopedic spine surgeon. That patient will require admission to a unit where they are monitored, and there needs to be attention to the hemodynamic management to avoid hypotension, and very often early surgical intervention in such individuals is advocated.
Okay, thank you. Moving on to pitfalls in management. What are the main pitfalls in management, would you say?
Probably the most important pitfall is to miss the diagnosis. So another a pitfall that I've seen are individuals who have arthritic conditions such as ankylosing spondylitis, or DISH, or diffuse idiopathic scleral hyperostosis. So these are bone hardening conditions. The spine is rigid but brittle. And in such individuals, you can miss an injury. So if you have a patient coming in where it's a very arthritic spine and it looks funny, be very careful not to miss a diagnosis and have a low threshold to go to advanced imaging, including an MRI. So I would say the number one point is don't miss the diagnosis. And one would say, well, how can you miss a spinal cord injury? It's so obvious. Well, it's not always so obvious, because some of these patients will come in and they will have a central cord injury where there's no evidence of a cervical fracture. You do a quick review in casualty, and the patients are moving everything, but be more detailed. Listen to the patient. If they're complaining of hand weakness and burning in the hands, they've got a spinal cord injury. It's a central cord injury. So you need to be aware of this. And those patients need to be referred to an appropriate specialty in the management protocols for a cervical spinal cord injury need to be invoked. And again, I made reference to the challenges if patients are intoxicated. So, alcohol, as we're aware, can be related to trauma, and then the presence of a distracting injury. So if patients have polytrauma, in those patients, you need to basically scan the entire spine and then to review this. And then don't hesitate to involve a colleague in the review of the imaging. So even myself, as a very experienced spinal neurosurgeon, I will always ask for a formal report from the radiologist to review this, because it's very helpful to have two sets of eyes reviewing the reports.
Okay, thank you. Last question is about questions, really. What have we missed? What other questions do you get asked about acute cervical spine trauma?
Yeah, so a common question relates to the use of methylprednisolone or corticosteroids in the setting of a spinal cord injury. And this has been an area of quite a bit of back and forth and controversy. And I would say that as a general physician or a surgeon assessing a patient in the casualty in the emergency room, you should ask your colleague or your consulting surgeons. The most recent guidelines, which were published by the AO in the Global Spine Journal in 2017, extensively reviewed the use of methylprednisolone, and it was felt that this is an option in patients who have a severe spinal cord injury, provided that in the physician's judgment that the risks of immunosuppression are minimal and that the patient could safely tolerate high-dose methylprednisolone. And it's also critical that the methylprednisolone be instituted within 8 hours of the injury. So I would invite people to review the AO Spine guidelines from 2017. And these are referenced in our BMJ document. So that is a common point. And then another common question that I'm asked is, okay, let's say that there is a cervical spine fracture and the individual has an injury with some evidence of spinal cord compression. Those patients in general should be operated on within an earlier time frame. So it's important to make that diagnosis. And the phrase that has evolved that we've championed is time is spine. So those patients should be operated in a time critical fashion. And again, I think making a diagnosis and then involving the specialist teams are is quite helpful. And, again, I'll put in a plug for our BMJ protocol document, which I think nicely summarizes in a practical fashion, the key issues.
Fantastic. Thank you. Because you've done so well, I'm going to ask even some tougher questions now, Michael. Sorry about that in advance. The patient with polytrauma and they've got a brain injury and cervical spine injury. Which one do you start on? Or are you going to tell me that it depends?
Yeah, so it depends. I think the first point is that in a patient who has polytrauma or a traumatic brain injury, you need to assume that there is a spine injury. And so the patient should have a complete CT scan, essentially from the skull base right down to the tailbone, with a careful review of this, then section CTs, recognizing that about 10% of patients with a traumatic brain injury will have involvement of the cervical spine. So, the decisions then become, in a polytrauma patient, how do you prioritize the management of the patient? And here, often a top-down approach is involved. So if there's a severe traumatic brain injury, that's a life-threatening injury, that often will require the immediate type of a management. On the other hand, if the traumatic brain injury is of a milder nature, but there's a serious spinal cord injury, that takes a top priority. And then in general, a spine injury is among the more serious injuries and should be quite high on the protocol of the management algorithms. What would supersede this? Well, other life-threatening injuries. So there's a pneumothorax or a serious chest injury, or if the patient is hemorrhaging from a critical area, that will take precedence. So I think there's a considerable amount of judgment that's required.
Got it. Thank you. And this, I promise, is my final question. You mentioned falls in older people, and I think you also mentioned hypotension as well. What if the older person has heart failure? How are you going to manage the hypotension and heart failure and cervical spine trauma all in one go? Or are you going to call in the physicians? Over to you.
Yes. So you raise a very good point. And one of the big clinical challenges that we're now seeing with the shifting demographics in our society with older patients are that we're seeing more older individuals with medical comorbidities who are presenting with a cervical spinal cord injury following a fall. And a principle of management is to avoid hypotension, which is defined as systolic pressure below 90 millimeters of mercury, and optimally to try to maintain cord perfusion by maintaining mean arterial blood pressures of 80 to 85 millimeters of mercury or greater. So those are principles. Now, how do you manage this in an older individual, particularly if they have cardiovascular disease? In here, one should involve the critical care physicians to assist one with that, because these are more complex patients. Those individuals should be in a monitored unit where they've got arterial blood pressure monitoring, and then judgment needs to be invoked. But in general, in an individual with heart failure, you want to avoid fluid boluses, because you'll put those individuals into pulmonary edema, and you'll tend to have a lower threshold, for example, to going to an inotropic medication. And again, the choice of the inotrope and so on, there's different medications, dopamine, norepinephrine, and so on. And here I would get a consultation with the intensive care physicians and have a discussion back and forth on the optimal management.
Okay. Thank you very much, Michael. And thanks to you all for listening. We hope that this has been helpful, and we hope you'll be able to put what you've learned into action to better diagnose and manage affected patients. If you want to find out more, click the link in the podcast to sign into BMJ Best Practice and look at the content on this and other relevant diseases. Thank you once again.